Hello, cyclocross friends, and welcome to episode 49 of Crosshairs Radio, or I think today we're referring to it as the Double Dan Show. Dan Chabanoff and Dan Langlois spent Saturday night in my basement for DCCX. Not a murder basement, just the place that they slept and were close to the course so they could go and race or wrench or whatever it was that they had to do over the weekend. DCCX, that was this past Saturday and Sunday. It's now Monday. Going through what I think people refer to as the cyclocross hangover today. It's still, the event may be over, but the work still is to be done, answering a lot of texts and emails and, you know, still doing some cleanup and just sort of tying up those loose ends. But it was an awesome weekend. If you are out here for DCCX, either as a racer or a spectator, thank you so much. Thanks for making it the big success that it was. If you weren't here and followed along to our Twitter or Instagram feeds at DCCX Race, thank you so much for doing that. I think that was successful, and hopefully you all were able to keep up to date with what was going on in the races. And if you did neither of those, why? And change that. Come out next year, 2017, DCCX. We'd love to see you in the nation's capital, assuming that, yeah, we're talking about the United States. So the United States, nation's capital. I know some of you aren't in the United States, so I just want to make that clear. On today's show, as I mentioned, Dan Chabanoff and Dan Langlois. This one just sort of got out of control for me. Dan Chabanoff pretty much just sat down and took over. So it's his show, and I guess we'll all, you know, find out what happened. No real sponsor this time. I just want to get going with the program. So let's do that right now. Welcome to the Dan and Dan Show.
Very bright floral.
Really?
Yeah. I mean, I should send you a picture.
How many knots per square inch?
I have no idea. This is like, now you're getting into like literal carpet salesman territory.
No, that's rug salesman. Carpet's different.
Rugs.
Carpet's different. Oh
my God.
All right. Should we start?
Yeah.
We may have already.
We did, but I think, all right, so Bill, you've obviously been on this podcast a few times.
Yep. Thanks for having me back.
welcome to the Double Dan Show.
I'm glad we could negotiate the contract.
Yeah. It'll be in your company's newsletter. Okay, never mind. But yeah, and I've been here before.
Mm-hmm.
But Dan's new, so I feel like, Dan Langlois.
Thank you.
Some people pronounce it Langlois, so let's clear this up definitively. You have to know how to pronounce your last name.
I know how to pronounce it, but like it's a split in my family. It doesn't matter. Like it's.
So which side says what?
Well, only one side has Langlois as the last name, but most of my aunts and uncles will say Langlois, but they grew up saying Langlois, and that was like not cool to them when they lived in Worcester, Massachusetts. So they wanted to say Langlois because it was like it was phonetic, I guess.
Did anybody want to just put a Y in there and just change the spelling?
Yeah, probably. But I go with Langlois. I get my aunts and uncles are like, kind of give me the side eye a little bit, like they think it's trying to be snooty or something, but they grew up like they couldn't speak English in their house, and then so Langlois wasn't cool to them, you know, so it's all Langlois, but I go Langlois. My dad thinks it's a kick.
All right, so you and your dad basically different pronunciations for your last name.
Yeah, he's got a really thick Worcester accent, like really he just
so who knows what he's saying.
Yeah, I have to translate for my wife sometimes. It's great.
And I feel like some people might also know you as Action Dan, which is your, I don't even know where that came from or like what that's all about, but
in my early 20s, I got a tattoo on my wrist that says Action. And so then it was a way to differentiate me from other Dans.
Fair enough. That's how when I moved to New York, I became Jersey Dan. Because there was already
wait, you have a Jersey tattoo on your wrist?
No, I went to high school in New Jersey. Damn it! It's college all over again.
Maybe your college experience. Mine's way different.
So I feel like every time you have somebody new on, we kind of like talk, or you. I don't know why I'm acting.
You sat down and you took control.
Why I'm acting like I host this show.
I am loving every second of it. So this is now a Crosshairs Radio hosted by Dan Chabanow.
But you feel free to tell me how Bill runs the show.
What I was going to say is, we usually go through how Bill usually goes through how the person like got into bikes and into bike racing and into cyclocross, and I guess for you also how you got into wrenching professionally, and you know you're here in DCCX, which is a lovely race that we'll probably talk more about later. You're wrenching for Arlie Kemmer, who's also been on the podcast, and her team, Fearless Femme. You got three riders. We can get to that. How did you start riding bikes? How did you get into racing bikes and then racing cyclocross? I know it's a long story. I can see the heaviness of all of it in your eyes.
The older the person that you ask that question, like the more effort it takes to answer.
Yeah, but then the farther away you are from it, so the better the story gets.
Yeah, that's kind of true. I started riding bikes because I lived in like kind of the sticks of Massachusetts, and then I needed to get to work, so I started riding my bike from one place to the other. So I used to be really into motorcycles when I was in my late teens, and I kind of gave them up because they were just, I liked working on them and all, but they're kind of hassle, and like avoiding cops was a big issue because there's always something generally legally off on whatever I was riding around, because they could steal plates from one bike to the other, or you know, kind of just haphazardly do whatever. Because, you know, when you live in the sticks, you don't think anything's really going to happen. Anyway, long story short, things happened. Nothing crazy, but, like, it got to be a hassle. So I got on a bicycle and started pedaling around. And, like, it was pretty fun. And I liked the time to myself. And then...
What year was that, you'd say?
94, 95, I guess.
Okay.
And then... And then I started really liking riding. I don't know what it... I know what it was, but it was like a multitude of different things. I started really enjoying my time on the bike. And I had a little bit of a knack for it in a way that just like... I liked to pedal hard and fast. And you kind of like inadvertently developed some other latent sense of athletics that I never tapped into before except for skating. And as individual, like skating, which is the only other thing pursuit I ever really tried. And so then I just kind of took to it and saw what would happen. I worked at a golf course at the time, and I lived at this like radical collective in Worcester, Massachusetts. And I bought a bike, like a old Nishiki, and I took the rack off of it.
Was it one of those triple triangle Nishikis?
No, it was
that cool.
It was a classy. I mean, it was a classy, but already like 15 years old Nishiki, like Olympic. It was red and white, but it had some nice like Mavic handbuilt wheels, and I was like, price was pretty right, and I was like, okay, I need a bike to get back and forth to work. And this seems like it'd be fun to ride. And then I found out about like a local time trial, which I don't know anything about time trials, but it was something to like test yourself against others. Cause I've been riding, and the route I would ride to work and back was really hilly. And I thought it was fun. Like, I'm like, oh, I wonder how fast I am with like people that ride bikes. So I got out of work one day, my friend put me in his van, and I just had my work gear. So I had like this, this like Budweiser t-shirt on and some army shorts, and I brought like a pair of sneakers with me to like ride in after work, which I think I just normally rode in like Doc Martens or something like that to work. And so then, so I get to this time trial and I had to borrow a helmet from somebody. And so, and then I got to this time trial and I like just hammered around this course in outside of like Sterling, Mass. And like, I was like, did okay in a weird way. I was like, this is kind of cool. And so then, longer story short, I ended up trying racing and liking it and trying to get better at it. And then,
did you do road first?
I actually did mountain biking first.
Interesting.
Yes, it's weird. Road racing seemed to be like, I got into road riding when I lived like in a competitive in group riding type way in Florida. I lived in Gainesville and I kind of moved down there to get into that stuff and to get into bike mechanics and all that, just because it was a way bigger scene than Worcester, Massachusetts, if you could imagine that. And
Boston seems closer, but okay.
Yeah, but when you live in Worcester, you don't want to be going to Boston. It's not really the thing. There's some unstated line that's just like,
oh, okay,
that right. Says like, here be dragons, Boston, and okay. Like Worcester's like, here be meth, but that's fine too. So in Florida, I started doing this road stuff, but the point of entry in road racing in Florida is insane because, you know, the nearest race you might be 5 hours away on any given weekend. Like, right. There's nothing really nearby. We had one crit in Gainesville, which I did, which was kind of fun, but really confusing. Yeah, but I tried it and it was cool. But mountain biking was the thing I always did because it was close. And in Worcester, I lived across the street from like a big trail system. And in Gainesville, there was tons of mountain biking and also good road biking. But the races just seemed like I didn't have a car and it just didn't know how to even get into it. Like, I didn't like other bike racers as like as friends. Like, it was a different breed in Florida. I don't know if understand like the DRZ, the Durag Zone, and like the
no, I will tell you right now, I don't understand it at all. But every time I hear stories like that about those kinds of scenes where like the closest race is like a 5 hour drive, I realize just how lucky I was to like start racing road bikes in New York, whereas like any given week in the summer you could race five times in a, like a USAC sanctioned environment within riding distance of your house.
Yeah.
You know, like two park races a weekend, track on Wednesday, Tuesday night Floyd, Thursday night Floyd, Thursday night Rockley. I mean, it's insane.
Right.
You know, and I don't even know how people get into racing bikes if like literally you have to drive 5 hours just to get to a race.
Right. Well, at the collegiate point, which is like where the people I was mostly riding with, because we're, you know, similar aged, and they had daily practices, I could show up and like kind of learn how to do intervals and like learn what are good structures for that type of training. I would do that, but they get like, you know, the college supports
collegiate
season, which
they have a big van, drive them around.
Yeah,
which they do shenanigans in.
Yeah, exactly. A lot of mooning on the highway.
Yeah, stuff I mean, like that. Harley did that to me last season.
Collegiate racer.
That's true. She's also a collegiate ski racer.
Yeah.
So that's got
shenanigans are high on the priority list. So back then, anyway. So then racing was cool, but then I decided I actually really liked it and I wanted to try. Like, I was kind of getting a little bit better at like fast riding and whatnot. So I moved back to New England anyway for a multitude of reasons, but one was just to get like, I've been working at shops down there and my mechanics were getting good and I had some really good training. And I'm like, I'm going back to New England. You know, I think I can race there because I can go to like, you know, like in New York, I can go to any race within an hour on the weekend. I could take a train there. I could ride there. Like, maybe I can make this work. And then, so I started racing. It was fun. On the road, but mountain biking I started with, and I was like, this is cool, but I'm alone. Like,
yeah.
You know, like, I'm a social creature. Like, don't put me in the woods alone for, like, 3 hours and, like, expect me to, like, reach an objective. It doesn't work at all.
That would have been Dan number three. If we had him
Yeah. Oh, man. Oh,
right. And so then...
We can only speculate about what Timmerman is doing right now. He's probably, like, hunting on the Armed Forces retirement grounds, just, like, over a campfire. If he hears this, he would be like... What are you talking about? You know that's not how I live. There's indoor... you can pee inside my house now. Can't poop.
No. That's fine, though. And so, then... What?
Oh, I was going to say, when... Yeah. When was the... Like, what year was your first cross race?
I think it was... Yeah. You could probably look at cross results and find out, but I think it was 2005. It was the Plymouth... Massachusetts, like, cross race that happens at a high school. I had this touring bike I had made, or, like, I had bought, like, an old Lotus frame that took 27-inch wheels, and I brazed on some canny mounts a little bit lower and put 700C wheels on it.
Oh, was that when you were working at Circle A?
It was when I was working at Circle A.
Did you bother painting it?
No. No way. Not even close. And then I threw, like, a bar end shifter on and, like, I had seen, like, single rings were super cool back then, and so, like, I did this funny single ring setup and had some goofy wheels, and I was like, all right, let's try this out. And I had a blast. It was just fun. Like, you know, I did okay, better than I thought I would do, I guess. Mm-hmm. And it was fun. I raced the Bees. And then that was, like, a November race. I didn't really race anymore that year, except in Rhode Island where I lived, we had this weekly Wednesday series at this place called Chase Farm, which was super fun. It was just Wednesday night worlds for cross racing, and it was a blast. And, you know, Mark McCormick would come out and just, like, in a couple other, like,
would
bangers.
Would he
like
start
that.
Like 2 minutes behind you?
No.
I heard that's a thing he does, right?
Yeah. Well, that's, and then isn't he coaching Curtis White? So he made him do that
at, like,
last year.
Yeah.
Oh, is that right?
At the Fruitland Cup, I think, yeah. Which is this weekend. New England has, like, 7 races this weekend, I heard. I don't know why.
That's a popular weekend.
Well, it's, I mean, even, what, there's 2 races this weekend near Philly. There's a PACX
right.
and a MAC race.
Yep.
And then, but everybody's here.
Yeah, that's right.
But,
yeah,
I heard no one went to Cleveland. I heard Cleveland was canceled.
Everyone got to the first run-up and then left.
Well, it is if you didn't get run over in the start. Sorry, Chelsea.
So, you had a touring bike.
Had a touring bike. Did a cross race. Really, really liked it. And then I got into it from, like, I just went in full steam. I kind of stopped road racing and just went into it pretty hard. It was wicked fun. It was it's just a better scene. People, you know, the community was way more kind of open and maybe a little more like-minded to me, and it was really fun. It was just I was way far away from the DRZ, and I was, like,
again,
super stoked.
Do rag zone for people who missed that.
What? Oh, I'm sorry. What is that exactly?
You don't know what the DRZ
no.
is? You've never been on, like, a ride, and this is probably a lot more common in Florida, but, like, if you find yourself around a bunch of people with do-rags under the helmets, the ride quality goes down 90%. There's a lot more yelling. There's a lot more, like, really lame jokes. Like, and not just, like...
I mean, that happens
lots of hold your lines.
That's like, every Central and Prospect Park ride in New York, as far as I'm aware. But I never attributed it to the do-rags. I just attributed it to the people.
Well, there's a certain person that wears the do-rag.
Oh, okay.
And well, that's...
I never made that connection.
DRZ, I'm liking that.
I have to give all originating credit to Rich Bravo, came up with the DRZ, which I think originated from just racing, you know, in New York all the time.
Probably, yeah.
I found myself in the deepest DRZ one time in a ride from Boston to Vermont. It was, like, this big ride, but it's hosted by this triathlete team, and it's a great ride, but, man, like, I was in, like, this 60-person DRZ. And there were just so many petty arguments, and like, it was like a blowhard to your right and a blowhard to your left, and they're trying to, like, argue across in front of you, and, you know, you got to wash your hands of it at some point. You just say, I'm done.
I feel like we should be playing some CCR underneath this while you're talking about it.
There's a deep cut, Bill. There's a deep cut.
So, 2005 Racing Cross, 11 years ago, up in New England. New England, you know, always had that scene, and it was always a big scene. So that is really the, at that time, places like the Mid-Atlantic, places like the Midwest are really just growing their scenes. You know, we're just getting to the point that we're over, like, you know, 70 people show up for the whole day to getting bigger and bigger fields, and we're just really starting that cross boom. What is the scene looking like at that time, and what has the evolution really been since 2005 till now?
Well, I think for me, like, walking, you know, when you go to a road race, the road race is isolated, whether it's in, you know, off spark crit or, you know, some road race out in the sticks. The race is encapsulated by itself. It doesn't really, there's no real community. Everybody's mostly, the only interactions people typically have is sizing each other up and trying to listen in on other teams' conversations or what their tactics are for the day. It's, nobody's trying to, like, hang out. Hey, what are you doing after? Hey, what do you like about things or in life? Like, it's just its own encapsulated form. When I went to the cross race, it was more of this, it's more of a carnival of sorts of just, and then there's just a lot more people interested in other people and other things. And, like, because it was so kind of even, I mean, I don't think it was new then, but there were a lot more, there was a bit large influx of people that cyclocross was new to in that area still at that point. And there still is now, which is great. And I think there's a lot of people that like to foster that and are very accessible and very eager to kind of, like, share knowledge, tell stories, you know, and create a little bit more. So for me, walking into that was super surprising, because not only are these people welcoming and fun and warm and pretty genuine, but then they're also the top level riders, you know, so everyone's right there to touch, you know, and, like, which I thought was pretty remarkable. And I think the way I see a lot of things change, or the way things have come up in cross racing, is that has been something that's been held across the board. I mean, you could go race in the Northwest, you could race down here, and there's just that, there's this really sense of fostering the best, what I think is the best parts of the sport, and making sure that they're actual concrete tenets of the sport and in the scene and the entire racing experience for people that have been here for a really long time, people that are doing their first race. And it's just really encouraging. And I think a lot of it attributes to, like, the actual style of racing. Like, nobody's really holding back in the race. Everybody's, it can be humbling, it can be flattering, it can be all this spectrum of things. But at the end of the day, you did your race, and it was good, it was bad. If it was bad, you'd do another one the next weekend. If it was good, kind of the same thing. So when you have that kind of level of, you know, vulnerability or honesty or whatever you kind of want to mark it as, there's just nothing left to, there's no other, like, there's no facade. So it's just it kind of lifts all boats in that regard. Because you might have that race, and you might have the best race of your life and still end, like, maybe second to last in your race. You might have, you know, the worst race in your life, and, you know, what you thought was a bad race, and end, like, in the middle of your field. It's all pretty subjective. And I think that's one of the best things I've seen in the growing of the sport. That's, there's the people that really participate in the sport and make it a really good thing for people. So, and still the idea of, like, today in DC, you know, you have the top level riders at your race, and, you know, they're just walking around. A new person would be like, you know, so many times you hear, I mean, you have somebody like such an icon in the sport, like Katie Compton, riding on this course. People are just showing up. She's riding, obviously, in the national kit, and it's just like, it's something very special about, that's a person I'm just coming to a sporting event seeing one of the top athletes in the world.
Not having to get a ticket, not having to pay admission. And if you went up and said hi, she'd have a conversation with you.
Yeah. And it's something you also have to pinch yourself about because it's, you know, not to make, you know, something insane out of the sport. It's a sport I love. And I think I put it on a really high level. And maybe other people don't necessarily do that, but there's not, you know, I don't think in that many places that's a really like tangible part of your sport. And I think
And then you get these crazy things like today. I mean, you know, not really, but if you're looking at other sports, if you're looking at a professional like at her level, they're not going to jump into an amateur race just to sort of mix it up like she did today, which was a great charge for everyone. Here's Katie Copton, 12-time national champion, won, you know, I can't even count how many World Cup races, and she is...
World Cup overalls.
Yeah, right. Exactly. World Cup championships, and she's just jumping in with the 35 Masters field, you know, for her warm-up. But the same thing. She's going to go out there and compete, and she was... you know, she got top five, but I was also, even after crashing, and still was able to, you know, and the best part of it, she's getting staged at the beginning of the race. Jim Patton, our local officials, like, you know, day of registration, last row. And it was a big field. At 35 plus, it was a big field.
They could have made some exception to that, but, I
can tell
it
you.
It sounds like she was just fine.
It was fine for her, and I'm sort of happy it worked out that way. I can tell you, if I was at staging, I would have probably talked to the official, and she would have moved up some, because we, you know, in the series, are supposed to have some discretion, at least in the third row, for who we can put in there for people showing up. So. But I thought it was a good thing, because it just added to the fun of it, watching her work her way through the field, you know, during that race.
Was sort of neat. She ended up like fourth?
Just fifth. Fifth. Yeah, fifth. With pretty much, you know, stacking it pretty hard at the barriers.
Right.
Damn.
And then, you know, I mean, might as well talk about this now. She ended up riding away from the women's
race. Yeah, and then she got into the women's race, and it was a typical... what we've seen this year, at least, a typical Katie Compton performance, where she is with the field for a couple laps and then just starts riding away. And, you know, it's she did it again today. It's not necessarily on the power sections. It's some of those technical turns that she, and especially anytime it goes downhill, she is just faster. And especially like downhill turns, she's just picking up a quarter of a second, half a second here and there.
So I actually noticed this at Charm City. And I know you talked about this a few times, but I was watching the Dirt Wire highlights from Saturday when it was very slick and muddy. And there was that corner, there was that right-hand corner going into the barriers.
Mm-hmm.
And everybody was like, most people were taking a tighter line where all the grass was gone, and it was just like mud. And they were still taking that wider line, and some people were sliding out, and some people were slipping out. And Katie Compton would go through and take all the whole outside where there was tons of grass still left because nobody was riding there. She was going literally twice as fast as Emma White in second place.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Through that one corner into the barriers. You know, Helen was taking a slightly wider line than Emma and was definitely smoother through that corner. But Katie was going all the way on the outside tape, just like railing it like it was a dry day.
What was Dan Chabanov doing in the race after that?
I was doing the Katie Compton line.
Yeah?
Yeah, absolutely. Because you had a reduced risk of crashing, you could carry more speed, and you weren't worried about sliding out when you went into the barriers. I mean, it was a kind of a no-brainer. It's like, I don't know, maybe she got it from Sven. I think you talked about the Sven
yeah.
line.
Yeah, I mean, that is the classic Sven line.
Yeah. Yeah, and...
it's, you know, it's the, yeah, what you get taught, it's, you know, the tape-to-tape and cutting off the apex, where that's just sort of thrown out the window and you just... ride the longest line around the turn.
Well, when you start thinking about how your tires actually work on a cross bike, and, you know, Powers talks about this at his clinics all the time, you know, it's like you want to not turn your front wheel. As you want to turn your front wheel basically as little as possible, because the less you turn your front wheel, the more momentum you can carry, the less you're testing the like forces of traction and grip of your tires, which are, you know, let's be realistic, it's a 33 mil tire with like tiny little knobs. It's like
sometimes 35.
Yeah, sometimes. Cleveland. Sorry, what?
Not 33. Yeah.
Oh, okay. 33. Yeah, anyway. It's not a mountain bike tire. There's not that much grip to play with. So it's like, it's really bike driving and cyclocross is, I mean, everybody who's raced cross knows this. Bike driving and cyclocross is everything, more than tread pattern, more than tire pressure. It's like, you have to know how to take advantage of the limited resources you have in the areas of traction. But yeah, why don't we talk more about the race today? I mean,
you want to do that? I mean, we had Dan, you know, just racing. Yeah. We didn't even get to him being a mechanic.
That's okay.
Well, Dan was a mechanic at the race today.
Yeah.
And it's funny. So I was speaking to Arlie after the race, who was one of the riders who was able to stay with Katie for as long as possible. And we're just kind of talking about that, like, magic of Katie's prowess and ride. And she's just like, she doesn't, Arlie was explaining it. It's like, Katie doesn't, never really throttled it in any section. It was just gradually bringing the speed, the pace, and her lines up to bear for the rest of the other riders to bear, to say. And, you know, Arlie's like, there was never one acceleration that anybody had.
So she like never attacked.
Never fully attacked.
Yeah.
But Arlie's just like, why is my heartbeat all of a sudden at 190? I feel like I'm just still doing the same thing. I'm just starting to maintain the wheel. And she was just like, I was confounded because, you know, I'm used to an attack. I can follow an attack for a little while. And you know, but it was just this constant ramping. And that's something to be, that's like formidable.
Yeah. Yeah.
It's kind of scary.
Yeah.
But it's also that ability to know that, to know where to start, which I think she does really well. And she's able to sit in. And it's the kind of stuff that we talk about, like with the pro races with like a Wout Van Aert and Vanderpool, where, you know, he does the same thing, that he's able to just sit in and just sort of slowly ramp it up until somebody gets in there who's, you know, as fast or faster than him, or just wants to screw with that rhythm that he's scared of. And then it's all of a sudden it's, you know, he's got to sort of go beyond what he wants to and maybe makes mistakes. So maybe we'll see that when Katie goes over to Europe, but I don't know. I think it's gonna be interesting to watch her this year. She is just, I especially after the last couple of years, she seems like she's on a different level.
She's having a lot of fun.
She is. Talking to her, I think definitely she's definitely in a good place.
Well, I think for a lot of people, sometimes like taking a step back from that full on lifestyle and sort of like taking control of your own racing, you know, and like making your own schedule and picking your own obligations. Sometimes it's like this big weight off, and people really thrive under that. I mean, you know, we definitely, yeah, I feel like we see that from certain riders time to time, and sometimes people just step away.
Yeah, I've seen that. Yeah, Cam Dodge. I've also seen, you know, there are guys even in the Masters field, really fast guys who sort of disappeared for a couple of years, came back. They weren't having fun, and now they're back and, you know, and just killing it again. Yeah, it's interesting.
Sometimes you just got to do what you like doing instead of what people think you should be doing.
Yeah, absolutely. You can get really into the thick of it and then just feel like there's no way out of the weeds until you realize that there is. You know, it is just, you know, cyclocross can be just a veil. Your season can be just a veil. And then once you kind of like, oh, but I actually still really love racing my bike. Let's find a way to do it in a way that I'm not going to be like chewing my own gums out by like, you know, adhering to like the strictest schedule and controlling every variable of my season. And, you know, that can just rain terror on your entire season. You know, like, you're just chasing your tail to make every opportunity great for you, where, you know, there's a lot of variables in this season.
Yeah.
Yeah. And not to maybe put words into somebody's mouth, but you know, a name that does come up a lot, or you were just talking about, and a guy who won the weekend at DCCX last year, Cam Dodge, it has almost become this mythical figure in cyclocross.
So I think you're partly responsible, but sure.
No, I get the question all the time. You know,
I've gotten the question too.
I know you have, and I know that you've talked to him.
Yeah.
So,
yeah, I mean, I saw him in Transylvania. He was, at Transylvania. He was racing 2 years ago.
Yeah.
Killing it. It was basically his like. I feel like Transylvania 2 years ago was his training camp. It was like his base ride training camp where he was just like, well, I'm done skiing for the year, so I guess I should like ride my mountain bike a little bit. And I think he podiumed a few stages, and that was like Justin Lundin was there, Timmerman was there. I mean, the kid is like in the 99th percentile of genetic gifts.
Right.
And this year he was just there. He was either riding as back marker for the racers, so he was like the last guy out on course on his mountain bike, picking up all the signs. He was out there for like 6 or 7 to 8 hours a day in the pouring rain a few days. or he was riding the moto at the front of the race. You know, and he was just having a blast, and he was like, yeah, you know, I don't really think I'm going to race this year. I just don't feel like it.
Yeah, but he didn't say anything definitive, like he's not racing again. It was just this year he just wasn't racing.
And, you know, it's like...
And that's the kind of thing, and I know that...
He's still riding his bike.
Yeah.
That's the thing. So but it's he can always come back to it.
That is the type of thing, and we saw this when we were talking about it, that I think a lot of amateur racers, especially ones who are super motivated, just can't understand why you would want to do that. And it even starts with the... You know, and I think there's a lot of misplaced when we talk about like Cam and like his sponsorship stuff,
right.
And like that it was always on. Why isn't somebody signing him? And even what this conversation we're having right now. Well, maybe A, I don't know that Cam wants to sign with anybody, or B, I don't know if he's just going to do his own thing. He's the best fit for a lot of places. So
yeah,
and that's the thing that I think it's just. Yeah, so it's good that you talked to him, because I think it's one of these things that people just can't wrap their heads around, having this kind of talent and not taking advantage of it. And I have my own thoughts on that. I think that's fine.
I think we all do, and I think, you know, it's like as a racer, yeah, I on the one hand I get it. I get not understanding that, because like as a racer, I'm like I fantasize about being able to pedal my bike as hard as he can. You know, it's like it's amazing, but at the same time it, you can't, you know, it's like what are you gonna do? Are you gonna run like a Soviet style talent ID like program through the entire country and just like pluck these people based on their like sporting ability and just like stick them in sports and like force them to do it until they're like late, you know?
Okay,
like,
so you're saying if he had raced nationals as a 9 year old, then he would.
This is officially the podcast of like, if you don't follow us on Twitter, you will not get any of these jokes.
Well, Cam's also funny, and I think a lot of guys his age, I mean, Cam was racing as like a 15-year-old beating guys in their 20s and 30s in their prime, you know, in mountain biking or in the PA region. I think he took it nationally when nationals just kind of came knocking and they were close by. He's like, I'm going to give it a whirl. And went to nationals, had a good time. He's like, maybe I can do this. And he can't. He obviously can do it. He's an incredible athlete, but he's also a really skilled electrician, and he's got a great job. Yeah. Makes a lot more money. Like, Cam was approached with offers to ride, and he was just like, for what? No, he'd make in half a year like twice as much as he was getting offered to ride. So he's like, it doesn't make sense. Why would I do it?
And his motivation, I think, is different, because he doesn't have reverence for the type of things that we have reverence for. You know, last year when I was talking to him about if he was going to go to Las Vegas. First World Cup ever in the U.S. This huge deal for everybody that follows cyclocross. And he was like, I've raced there before.
And it's a long
exactly,
drive.
Exactly.
And it's really long drive. And he said, I think and this was before Charm City was a C1. He's like, I can just go to Baltimore and race. That's the same thing for me. So it's really, he doesn't have that where he places these things as these like life goals as far as, successes in cyclocross go.
Right. Right. Which I find commendable on a level because I actually can't think of that. Like I never even had the ability to race at that level. So, I'm kind of in that boat where I'm like, oh my God, if I had a chance to race a World Cup, I'd quit a job to do it or something like that. Or at least at one point I did think that. And when I see him, like, oh yeah, you know what? There is like actually a lot of like.
Well, it's kind of like cycling isn't, it's not the real world.
Yeah, but that's why a lot of people, that's why we can get into it.
And that's okay. It's like, it's fine to love a sport, but you just have to fundamentally understand at the same time, like you have to hold these ideas both in your mind that it's totally fine to love a sport, but it's totally ridiculous to do it.
Right.
Like it makes no sense to love it. Right. And like, I think that's how you can understand somebody like Cam is like, you have to hold both of those ideas in your mind at the same time and just be like, I get it. He really loves racing bikes, but he also thinks it's like kind of a ridiculous thing to do probably.
Yeah.
And that's, so he's not willing to give up his entire life, which seems pretty freaking great. It's like to do this one thing and here's the other thing. At a certain point, when you do something you love as a job, it does become a job. And no matter how much you love it, there is, I've heard this from plenty of people that have either done it as a pro on the road, or it's a grind. It becomes a grind and it's hard. It's hard to just be like, man, I really have to go out there and I have to do these intervals, or like, I have to get this much riding in today. And it's like, oh, it's rain. There are days where it's going to be a real job, and I just don't think he ever wanted those days.
Right.
Know, and like, I don't blame him.
Yeah. I hate going to work in the rain. I hate it.
Yeah.
Not going to lie.
It sucks.
Yeah. And I know
I'm sure working the pit in the rain sucks too.
Yeah. I mean, I was kind of including all work in the rain.
Yeah.
Yeah. It's not fun. It's you're going to be busy. You have to commit to being wet. It's awful. Who wants to be wet?
That's, hey, you laugh.
I do. I get a tent.
We get tents too. We just have to leave them.
Yeah. Ugh. I just have to go put baggies over my equipment.
All right. So, Bill.
Yeah.
Second year DCCX UCI race. Still conflict with some other race somewhere that. We're not going to even mention anymore because it's not our, not worth our time.
Nah, we wish them the best.
But yeah, you asked me earlier for a report card but what's your take on it? Do you see a difference between year one, year two?
Yeah. I mean, there are some obvious things. And again, we are recording this on Saturday night, so we are only halfway through and anything can happen tomorrow.
Yeah. I mean, the flyover could catch on fire.
The flyover could catch or just miraculously appear out of thin air because there is no flyover. Yeah. But look, last year was our first year as a UCI race. We wanted everything to go perfect. We wanted to really make our mark on the national calendar. We had been, the race was in its ninth year, so it was an established race. Figured we sort of knew how things worked with this race. We get there, everything seems fine, and this scoring just shits the bed, and we have no results for anybody. And it's just a complete nightmare. It's something that doing local races every week in and out for years never happens. We get to our biggest race in this area in years, and it's just a complete nightmare. So that first day, definitely, if I'm sitting here now a year later on Saturday night, I have to say this is 1,000 times better than how I was feeling when we were recording this podcast last year.
To your credit, if you hadn't told me that last year, I would not have known.
Yeah, I wouldn't have never known.
Yeah, well, but that's the thing also, that it was... We kind of joke, but it's the absolute truth that UCI races, make it or fail off the backs of amateur racing. That's what pays the bills.
Absolutely.
So you want to give those folks a good experience. You want them to come there and have an awesome day. We hope, and in DC, we're really lucky because a lot of those folks, and along with their families and their friends, hang around and watch the pro races at the end of the day. So we get a nice environment and a nice atmosphere the whole day long. If we don't provide those people at a race where they're coming saying, hey, I'm racing DCCX. This is the same race that Katie Compton's going to race on the same course I'm racing at. This is a big deal for me. And then we don't give them the experience that they deserve for the money that they're paying, which isn't cheap, then we failed them.
Right.
And even though it's when it gets to the elite races, it's easy to hand score those races. Last year, it's like 50 and 40 for the men's and women. That's... Mm-hmm. We have 1,900 racers throughout the day. So we have an entire officiating crew that's scoring these races. I'm hoping that four officials can handle 50 people. And they can, right. And they did it. So there was no issues with that elite race. It was just the rest of the day. And that's a huge stressor for us because that's the kind of thing that we are dealing with, people who take this very seriously. Exactly what we were talking about. It's not their real job. It's their fantasy. It's what they do, but they work super hard at it, and it's mm-hmm. super important to them, and we want to make sure that it's right, and last year it wasn't right. So, starting with that, awesome day today. Nothing but, kudos all the way around as far as our amateur races go. And then when we got to our elite races at the end of the day, I thought they went smoothly. I thought we had, we got Katie Compton here, which was just really super awesome. And as we already talked about, she was able to do what she's doing at C1 races, what she was doing at Jingle Cross at a World Cup race against the best in the world. She's just at a level now where she's better than anybody else. So Without something catastrophic happening, you sort of figure that race is sort of taken care of. Men's race, awesome race. I mean,
wide open.
Super exciting. The course, I think, was faster this year.
Yeah.
I'm hoping people sometimes complain about a fast race not being a good cyclocross race, but I think you can make a fast race exciting and still have some technical points. And Dan, I want you to speak to that.
I want to say something about that because I feel like people like to shit on the quote-unquote grass crits, but the thing about fast cross races is, when people are like, oh, it's a race like Nittany, where it's like pretty flat, lots of corners, nothing super technical, but the thing that people forget is if it's possible to go fast on a race like that, at a course like that, the racers will just keep going faster until they crash.
The
pros will take it to the absolute limit of their technical ability. Like if you put a fast sweeping corner and you say this corner is a no brakes corner, someone is going to go fast enough into that corner to require brakes.
Well, and that's kind of how I explain this course, is that you make it a technical course.
Yes.
By exactly what you're saying, yes. By testing the speed limit into every corner.
Yes. And right. It was very, it was a very fast course. I didn't happen to catch my average race speed today, but I would guess it was 15, 16 miles an hour. But a lot of the turns were very loose in a very unpredictable way. And you really had to concentrate 100% of the time, because even like setting up one of those turns, if you set up one of those turns wrong, it could end in a washout pretty quick. It was not a race that you could zone out at. And particularly today with the wind, you had a lot of group racing. You know, you had a group of, I think, five.
Five up front, yeah.
Five up front. We had a group of four chasing. Mm-hmm. And it was, you know, the groups, I would say, stayed together for the whole race,
yeah.
Essentially. It was a right. sprint for both groups.
Mm-hmm. So when you're in that, you're in that second group really fighting for sixth place, more or less.
Mm-hmm.
At what point, or is there a point, you know, is there anything in your mind, or do you feel like even in the group where it's like they're out of the question getting up to that group? You know, when does that set in that, okay, this is my race?
So the way that chase group ended up forming is I was in the front group of about seven with Marion. Marion got blown off first with, I think, like two laps into the race. And I think I got dropped from that front group maybe like three laps into the race. And then when Marion came up to me, we started riding our own race. So maybe with six laps to go, we're riding our race. If something happens up front, like somebody flats, somebody crashes, they decide to sit up for whatever reason, like maybe we'll get to them, but we're racing for sixth now. Just because, you know, it's like in particularly windy race, lots of drafting. If you get blown off that front group, it's because they're pedaling harder than you can. You know, it's like we all have the lines dialed. They're just pedaling harder.
Mm-hmm.
And so as much as I want to be in that front group, I also have to be realistic that if I keep closing that gap lap after lap on the finishing straight, that like 3 second gap that I had the first time, it wasn't going to end well for me. And I also want to get a good result at some point, you know, this season, even though like I've been riding well enough to be top 20 at most of the C1s. Unfortunately, top 20 at a C1 is still not points. And like, it is nice to get points. So when I have an opportunity to race for sixth, I'm pretty happy with it to race for sixth. The guys in the front group, you know, Kerry Warner, Dan Timmerman, Cole Oberman, Anthony Clark, you know, and Adam Craig. Like, when you have a group like that, I think, you know, it's like Adam Craig is probably the quote-unquote weakest link in that group, but he can drive a bike like nobody's business,
right?
You know, yeah. And then Dan Timmerman and Kerry Warner are just powerhouses. You know, it's like both of those guys can pedal their bikes so hard they will make you bleed through your eyeballs. You know, and like Cole is just, I've raced mountain bikes with Cole this season, and he just starts riding hard and he doesn't stop for like 2 hours. And so it's like, you know, and Anthony's just, he's just wild and he can really hurt himself. And that's like an ability that he has. So it's the, you know, when guys like that gap you, it's kind of like there's, you gotta know, I say this a lot, but you have to know how good you are and how good you're not in bike racing. And you have to, and it's like, if you're trying to get a result, while it helps to be set your goals high, you know, and try to make that front group, it's also important to know when like to cut your losses because you're going to blow up, you know?
Right. And that I think that really demonstrates, we were talking earlier how, you know, this is a really tactical race. It's tactical at a very tangible level at the race, but it's also a UCI weekend where there's points on the line that are really instrumental through the rest of your season. And so like the tactics really boil down to like level after level in this, in a race like this.
Right. And there was, so I was in a chase group racing from sixth to ninth. So I don't even know what the Desperate Souls were doing back there for 10th.
Right.
You know, there was one more point on the line after our chase group. And
yeah. And it was still a battle for that. For that 10th spot, it was a group of two or three that came in. Yeah.
Right, and I was in those shoes last year when I dropped my chain and then I broke a derailleur cable.
Yep.
I snapped a derailleur cable
in the shifter.
Dan was my mechanic in the pit that year. Unfortunately, he wasn't available this year. So we have Spencer from the Slow Ride podcast.
I made myself available.
Uh-oh.
Just kidding.
I don't know, man. That's like bike messenger double dipping when you're working for two companies at the same day.
Yeah, I understand. It's tough.
I was racing for 10th last year, and it's a crazy mindset when you're racing for that last UCI point, because it's just like, it's almost like you're going for the win at like a local race or something, because you're like, man, if I can't do this.
Like, at what point do you realize you're on the 10th, like, you're, like, the potential for the 10th spot? Like, is it crowd people being like, you're 10th?
Usually it is the crowd. Usually it's the crowd, because it's so hard to count, you know? And, like, I actually do pride myself in road races, like, being able to count how many people I have in my breakaway. You know, so I'm always like, cool, I can get 6th today out of these 6 people.
Every breakaway needs a lead out.
Yeah, exactly. But in a cross race, it's harder, because you're like, you know, because especially in those early laps, you're like, you can sometimes count how many people you have in front of you. But oftentimes, like, at a race like Gloucester last weekend, it's so crazy in the start that, like, it feels like you have 20 people in front of you, but really there's 8.
Totally.
Yeah. You know?
There's so much dust. There's, you know, it's...
Right. Yeah. And so things start splitting up, and you're just kind of, like, riding and hoping.
Could you tell here, because, you know, we have a much more compact course, so there are a couple times, especially, like, when you go by pit one and loop back around, you're passing each other.
Yes, but when you're in a group with Robert Marion, his pit mechanic will always, always, always yell his place in the race to him.
Gotcha.
And you can hear if he's behind you and the guy is yelling, Rob, you're in 7th.
Right.
I can manage to do that, man.
It simplifies matters.
A little bit. I mean, sometimes it's hard to do whatever minus whatever when your heart rate is at 190.
It's true. I mean, for me, it's pretty much hard to pedal at my heart at 190. So, like, internal mental tasks are pretty inhibited.
I have a readout of everybody coming through, and it's still sometimes hard to figure it out.
Well, then throw another level on it, and now you're trying to make decisions about, do I try to pedal these guys off my wheel? Do I sit in? How do I get these guys to cooperate with me while sitting in? Where am I going to attack these guys? I have no, you know, it's like, there's so many things going through your mind that you're trying to not mess up while simultaneously trying to think about what's happening in front of your front wheel screw that up.
And at the same time, those guys are doing the exact same math, thinking about where they're going to attack. And then you have that whole other equation of reacting.
Right. Yeah. So, I mean, particularly today, I was banking on that long finish straight and trying to play that to my advantage, and kind of the whole last lap I was trying to defend 2nd spot in that group with Antonin. I feel like I should introduce him, because he's like been here for 3 months now from France with his dad, just like racing US cross. Seems like a really cool dude. Doesn't talk much English. But
which is kind of funny, because Taylor Jones, who he's staying with, is fluent in French, yet his dad and I think Antonin refused to speak to him in French and only want to speak to him in English.
That makes sense. They probably want to practice.
Yeah.
He's super strong. And he kind of took over driving the group with one to go. And I was like, cool, I just have to sit here in 2nd and try to hang on. And then Carl Decker attacked super hard into the 2nd part of the course with a little Rudy jump off the pavement. And then I tried to hang on to that. But then it felt like he was going too slow on that long back straight. So I was like, crap, I just have to go now and hope for the best. So I led over the log. Then Rob, Marion passed me and kind of... No. You know what? Carl Decker passed me back. I got back into second. Then Rob passed us on the pavement over the bridge going past pit two. Mm-hmm. And then I got on his wheel. And then what none of us kind of thought about or took into account was that the start-finish straight had a colossal tailwind today.
Oh, really?
There was overhauling.
Yeah. So basically, if you hit that
first one onto the pavement,
you won. Yeah. Even though it was... really long. It was a really long sprint, but it's just like there's only so much you can do with a 42.11.
Would you have considered, and maybe this is something for tomorrow, doing the Matthew Vanderpool foot down at the top of that little lip coming out of the pit too?
Again, that requires you to be first to the top of
right.
that lip.
Yeah.
So the first to the pavement rule still holds.
Right, so there's no sense in doing
but
that.
But I would not do that, especially in a group, because then third place is just like, well, I'm going to go right to the outside and just ride by you. I can see this. That only works if you're in a group of two and you know the person is on your inside.
And if we think about the race, you know, famously that happened, he still got caught and lost.
Right.
Yeah, I... think about that every once in a while, and I'm like, that shouldn't have happened. That just doesn't, you know, it's like you make someone go foot down right before a sprint, and right. you don't go foot down, but then you lose the sprint. Like, that is, it's not.
I mean, aren't these guys like 20 or 21 years old?
Yeah.
And I guess they don't really understand how
it was also, yet. it was a super long sprint, too. It looked like
it was a very still. Long uphill sprint, but I mean, impressive. That's all I gotta say. almost as impressive as the social media at the race today. I mean, that was the best.
Oh, nice segue.
That was the best Twitter feed.
Wait, who had a segue at the race?
What? I saw people riding segues in Philadelphia the other day, and I was like, what are you people doing? Why?
Why did this happen?
Were they part of a tour group? We have like Segway tour groups.
We have we have a lot of Segway tour groups. We also have just a lot of private owners of Segways.
Yeah, we got we have some, you know, every agency has their own security force, and some of those like ride around downtown on Segways.
That was a good segue, Dan.
Yeah, look at that. Look how we've done with this segue.
That was a segue within a segue. Yeah,
I mean, it's a rolling joke in more ways than one, right?
The two questions are...
The Slow Ride podcast can only hope for a good as segue as this.
Yeah, right.
Their segues are... could use some work.
Yeah, well, I mean, you know.
I mean, I don't know any Segway mechanics.
You could have had asking.
And you had to learn bike mechanics somehow.
Yeah, it was pre-Segway. It's, you know, it's a tough part of the industry. Maybe if I get into e-bikes, then we can, you know, we can delve into Segways.
Oh my God, there was a guy pre-riding the Gloucester course with an e-bike.
Oh,
brilliant.
Okay.
I love this.
I have nothing to say about it other than he was going slower than me in the corners.
Mm, yeah.
Let's talk about our great social media.
Well, the thing that stuck out to me was, you know, so it's pretty, you know, me and Brittley are by ourselves at this race. Mm-hmm. Richard could not come down because he's getting the new frame building shop, I think, needs like final inspection before he can like put the acetylene tanks in and burn the whole place down. I'm just kidding. we're also all a little drunk, I should say. Anyway, so we're here by ourselves, and he was following the race on Twitter. He knew exactly, you know, normally when we're at a race like this, he emails me first thing and is like, how'd your race go? What place did you get? What did Brittley get? What did whoever else is at the race get? Who did you beat? Like, basically, I have to forward him the results.
Right.
So he can just look at them himself because it's too many questions. But today, that did not happen because he was following the race on Twitter. He knew exactly what place I got. And then when he couldn't find Britley's result, he tweeted at the race, and the race just got back to him with what Britley got today.
Yeah.
And that just, I've never seen that happen with any race in the U.S., at least. Like, I mean, I don't follow Belgian cyclocross Twitter, but I imagine it's not as good.
I don't think it exists. It does not exist.
I don't, yeah. Well, I can't imagine that happening.
You know, not to hurt myself patting myself on the back, but
hurt away.
But here's what we did. We think that that's a priority, and we want to get that message out there. So I had somebody working with me next to me while I was announcing, who had his computer set up. We had an internet hotspot set up, and he was live tweeting the whole day. That was his job. You know, we had an awesome time. We hung out and we had fun, but he wasn't, you know, walking around as a volunteer, nothing against volunteers, saying, oh yeah, I'll tweet the race. It was like, this was his job for the day, and he did an awesome job, and he had a good sense of humor about it, but he got all the information out too.
Yeah, it was money well spent, because what I will say is, like, for people racing the UCI race, coverage, media coverage is way more important than, you know, the prize payout for 18th place.
Yeah. So, and to piggyback on that, you know, it's the kind of things that just me sort of doing what I do with a site and doing what I do with media and photography and video and whatever else. It's important to me, and I think that people should get paid for their work. So we hire a photographer. Bruce Buckley is our photographer. He was taking pictures. He was uploading those pictures from, you know, his professional setup, from his, you know, and sending them to not only the person who was doing, Nate Graham, who was doing our Twitter account, but also to Julie Kaliza, who came up and was hanging out, and we had her doing the Instagram. So she was running the Instagram feed for the race.
The Instagram story on the Instagram is great.
Yeah.
Unfortunately, by the time this probably gets published, it will have disappeared.
It will have disappeared.
But
yeah.
Anyway, it was awesome.
So
I flipped through it today in your shower.
Well, excellent.
And caught myself up.
But that's the thing, and we've already heard just amazing feedback from that outlay of, really, you know, it's not a huge investment. It's enough that these folks feel like they're getting paid fairly, and it's something that I think that every race should do, and you would raise, or don't do, you know, we'll just do it and raise our profile of our race, and you don't have to, but I think that it really helps the athletes, it helps the fans, and it gets you national attention without having to pay thousands upon thousands of dollars. You can do this easily if you just are strategic about it.
Yeah, congratulations on having the Gloucester of Mid-Atlantic racing.
Okay.
It's that good. Maybe better. I don't know. I mean, we might have to ask Spencer. It's really, I mean, for, what is it? I mean, I know the race has been around for more than a decade, but for a second year UCI event.
It's, yeah, like, I mean, but that's taking it to another level. And it's only been 2 days for maybe 4 years. You know, it was one day race after that, before that. So
I just,
that's right.
Yeah. I can see this race being a priority for a lot of people, in the very near future.
I will say the one thing that, just looking at who came to our race, and thank both of you for coming to our race, is that what makes me happy is that people came, I think, to our race where they may have been able to go elsewhere and get points, and they didn't do that.
Well, right. The parking here is just so easy.
That is it. It's the parking.
Parking is great. It's so close to the pit. It's excellent. But I think also,
one of those bridges is a little sketchy. We gotta.
It's fine. I was riding my bike through the
Oh, through the little culvert.
Yeah, yeah, nice. It's not that bad.
Not too bad. I think one of the big draws is, I mean, its proximity is great. You're drawing from the south, you're drawing from the west, and you're drawing from the north pretty easily. You know, within 6 hours, people that don't seem to mind saddling up in their car coming down. That's pretty awesome. It's also in D.C., so if you have an extra time, spend another extra day here. Last year, when I was here, spent a couple of days, and I hadn't been to the museums here since, like, the year 2000. It was awesome, you know.
Yeah.
It's a great place to go. And then also, yeah, I mean, the race is great. It had a really good groundswell before the UCI. I mean, when I moved to Philadelphia, people were like, oh, have you raced DCCX? It's in the city. So, you know, there's things to do after the race. There's things to do before the race. There's amenities. But then it's this, like, enclave of woods in the city. And I remember, like, it kind of, like, striking something in my brain, being like, oh, wait, that's the kind of stuff that I love. And then finally, the UCI race, yeah, I finally got the chance to come down and do it. And I was like, why haven't I been here for the past, you know, at that point, 9 years, I guess. You know, it just made perfect sense. Like, everything was set up. It was set up like a venue that had the experience of running excellent racing. You know, there's the density of the kind of, you know, the infield, if you want to call it, at the race, where, you know, the podium is and a few vendors and whatnot. That feels like a big pro setup without being as overwhelming as like an expo. But then you also have just super easy navigation of the entire course, the course cuttings to get through from one place to the other, and to the pit and parking. It's just, it's pretty well done. And you can tell, it just comes through that it's been tried and true.
Yeah.
You know, rather than, you know, a first year race that maybe they were a local race for 1 year, they want to go to UCI because there's nothing else in their locality, in their area.
Or just working out a new venue.
General, yeah.
Yeah.
The bugs are already out.
The benefit of being there for so long is that, yeah, it definitely has gone through all those growing pains, and we've figured out what exact accessibility and everything else and what works.
And it's just, it's awesome to come here and have people watch the race and have people care about the race. And I mean, like, the whole time I was racing, every corner of the course, people are screaming my name. I always enjoy, you know, for the first two laps when I was riding behind Timmerman, I always want to yell back, which one? And yell, go, damn. You know, just because that's...
You got to figure out who wears the allegiance.
Right, exactly. Yeah. Who are you? Come on.
That's why you drop back, isn't it? Yeah. You're just like,
I just need to figure this out. I need to figure out who people are really cheering for. Yeah. But, you know, it's like, it's true. I mean, I feel like it happens all the time. People, you know, it's like there's a balancing act that goes on with promoting a race. It's like, how good is the venue? How good are the amenities? How good are the parking? And then where is it? You know, it's like, you can find a great venue that has all these things, but is in the middle of nowhere, and people just, you know, no one comes there unless they're also racing.
Right. Yeah.
And this is not a venue that has that problem. People just get on their bikes from all over DC,
right,
and just roll down and hang out for the day. I would say there's a ton of people there that were not racing.
All the messengers, instead of hanging out at, you know, DuPont Circle or Farragut North, just sort of rode over and, you know, hung out at the race for the day. So that's, that kind of stuff is awesome. And it is easily accessible, and, you know, the beer is cheap.
Yeah. And yeah. and things like that, like, while they're not, you know, while they're not standards that you can realistically impose on every race promoter, it's like what cyclocross racing should be. It should be an event that draws people that are not just there to participate.
Yeah.
You know,
but that is difficult to do in many places. And that's why we are, you know, we're lucky. We're lucky that we're here. We're lucky in this area. It's the kind of thing that we talk about when we look at other UCI races that don't get the draw, and what we were talking about earlier with the amateurs that really support it, is that we are spoiled here in our density, and we're spoiled here in that people like to race. So we're going to draw, you know, it's kind of like New England, and we're not even at that level. We're below that. You know, Gloucester got 2,200 people racing for 2 days. We'll have 1,800, you know,
pretty close.
Yeah, yeah. But we're right up there, and it's really cool, you know. And then, and our Rest of Us series, which, you know, this is the Super 8, which is the series I always say that nobody knows about, the biggest series nobody knows about. We're getting, you know, 500, 600 people a race day.
Yeah. So, right.
Because they're here, and we are spoiled. Much like you were saying with your road racing in New York, we can go to two races a weekend and not drive more than an hour.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, That's one thing that I love about having moved to Philadelphia, because you can't do that in New York. Even if the race on Google Maps says,
right,
you know, 2 hours, it's going to take you 4 hours, because it takes 2 hours just to, like, get out of your parking spot in Brooklyn.
Right.
And get through traffic to get on a highway to, like, pay the Port Authority a colossal sum of money to let them, for them to let you leave the island of Manhattan. You know, and then they're also going to charge you an arm and the leg on the way home. And it's just, So I'll just tell one last funny story. We were driving back from Gloucester last weekend, and my drive from Gloucester to Philly is about 6 hours. And Brittley was driving back to Manhattan, and I think it was around, like, maybe it was around like 11 o'clock. We stopped at one of the wonderful Merritt Parkway rest areas in Connecticut. I think it was the last Merritt Parkway rest area in Connecticut, and got gas, whatever. We were in separate cars, but we just kept running into each other at these rest stops. Anyway, so she was like, oh, how far is it from you? And I was like, oh, I'm about 2 hours from home. And she's like, oh man, that sucks. I'm like 40 minutes from home. And I was like, yeah, but by the time you get home, unload your car, find a spot where you can park,
yeah,
and like actually get in bed, I will have been asleep for half an hour. And that, I'm pretty sure, based on her social media likes,
yeah,
that evening, like what time she was liking things, that was the case. Oh,
outstanding. Outstanding.
That's some sleuthing.
Yeah.
Well, I mean.
Yeah, that's still.
No, I'm really in tune with my Instagram
accounts. Well, One thing I will add just as an addendum for the success of DCCX is that DCMTB, which is a team that started the race, has done an incredible job. And they're the ones that secured that venue and really built up this race, you know, for 8 years and continue to build it up. And we partnered with them 3 years ago. Crosshair Cycling came in, was able to help them, you know, just from our partnership, to help the race go to 2 days and then also to become a UCI race. So it's been a huge success, but really, you know, a lot of the credit goes to that DCMTB crowd. On top of that, I don't want to let myself off the hook because, you know, we talked about podiums. It's been a big thing.
I was not going to bring this up.
I know,
up.
I know you weren't. But I wasn't going to bring this up. It was out there, and I don't want to shy away.
I did tweet about it.
I don't want to shy away.
Everybody seemed to ignore it. mostly because it was pretty obvious that I was just trolling you.
Yeah. So I did a stick figure drawing last week,
which people took really seriously.
For a stick figure drawing.
Well, for any right. drawing. I mean, like, I've seen less philosophical debate yeah. about, like, Picasso's than I did about this. Like, I mean, people were, like, really debating the nature of life and, like, what it means to, like, yeah. be on a podium and, like, what you should be allowed and, like, who is to judge. I mean,
you know, there was bananas. Outrage over what hand should be raised, or if it's, you know, just some sort of if you
podium accoutrement.
Yeah,
shall we say?
Yeah. But even absolutely. Just somebody, the man holding you down, saying you can't put both of your hands up if you're second or third place, you right, know, that kind right, of thing. And then, right. yes, exactly, to the podium bike. But the thing that I heard about today, after putting this out, and if you read my diagram closely,
it does say if you must.
Yes,
I know,
but I thought that was for the dirt steps.
No, that was because I'm a, you know, as we talked about, I'm a secret lawyer, non-practicing lawyer. I was giving myself an out. The series that I am the director of, if I had my way, I would love to do a three-step podium as an announcer. There's nothing better than not having to do a five-step podium. However,
yeah, it's like two
less people you have to corral, yeah. two less people you have to find. But the culture of our Mid-Atlantic cyclocross is a five-step podium. Getting people to change out of that is an uphill battle that I continue to fight. But in the meantime, I have to do what the people want.
Well, it's
and
okay,
what the rules
the
are.
UCI race is a not series race.
It is not, and it was three.
Exactly.
It was three.
And I know some people were disappointed.
Yeah. So we do in our amateur races still have a wide
open. You know who you are.
However.
Well, actually, anybody can look at the results and figure out who they were. Never mind. Sorry. I just called some people out.
Still
he's
no.
He's a mountain biker. It's fine.
I mean, Ed, you raced like a bunch of mountain bike races this spring. Is
yeah, like 16 people. Like,
yeah, 20 people get on the podium at once.
Well, all right. This is what happens. They call you up to give you your money, and right. These people just stay up there. And I don't know why.
I was at a race that the promoter wanted them to stay up there. And then just
that's weird.
And then just the faces of sadness from, like, you know, 15th place, I would have left.
And if the promoter would have been like, stay up here, I would have been like, why? Give me a reason.
You already paid me.
Yeah, like, I'm going home. Thank you. I'll put on another race if you want me to come back.
No podium bikes were harmed at DCCX or existed or made a show.
I didn't hear of anybody even wanting to bring that up. It's just...
Yeah. And again, we blame all of that on your mechanic today and his podcast, the Slow Ride Podcast.
Oh, well, I do think there is a proportionate... So, like, the amount of podium bike incidents has exponentially increased... since they have started talking about podium bikes.
Yeah.
So I think there is like...
Don't spit on the subway and all of a sudden you're like holding back that phlegm like you must spit.
I've never heard of that, but now I'm going to have to spit on something.
Exactly. So. So, yeah. Podium bikes are like spitting on the subway.
That's right.
Yeah. And if you don't follow us on Twitter, you probably didn't get any of these jokes.
Yep. Go subscribe to the Wide Angle Podium.
I'm not obligated to tell you that. But I like the Honest Bicycle Program. It's a good show.
It is a good show. And, you know, I look forward to hearing the lukewarm correspondence report from the pits.
Oh, my God. I do too, but I'm also scared.
Awesome. All right. Well, it is now 11:44.
Cool. So on track to go to sleep at my preferred midnight after finishing a bottle of whiskey.
That gives me a good 5 hours. You know?
Dude, that's great.
Yeah, five hours is perfect.
5 hours is perfect.
I'm an old man. That's all I need.
Yeah, all right. You probably, if you went to sleep earlier, you'd probably just wake up at like 3 a.m. and be like, why am I awake?
Yeah. So I need to make sure that I have everything I need out of the basement now. So I'm not down here at 5 a.m.
You're really giving people a true insight into this pro lifestyle that I'm leading in your basement.
And yeah.
Sharing a bed with a mechanic for a different team.
Duh. I mean,
he happens to be named Dan, so it's cool.
It all works.
Yeah, yeah. Absolutely. We're skinny.
All right, and on that note,
goodbye.
Thanks for listening to Crosshairs Radio. We'll talk to you next time. Thanks, Dan. And Dan.
Thank you. Bye-bye.
Bye.
All right, and there you have it. That was the Double Dan Show. Hope you enjoyed it. A little different, but, you know, a lot of good information snuck in there somehow. So I hope you all had a good time. If you want to get in touch with me, feedback@cxhairs.com is the email address, @cxhairs on Twitter and Instagram. Also, go to wideanglepodium.com, become a member, give a little back to this show, to the Slow Ride Podcast. Hey, Lukewarm will be, I believe, reporting live on the next Slow Ride Podcast. He was down at DCCX, so that's worth tuning in for. Also, Adam Meyerson, check out the Meyerson line, the consummate athlete. Kids Don't Follow, I heard a rumor that they will be recording a new episode soon, so check that one out as well. And for us, we have episode 50 coming up next. Stay tuned for that, and talk to you soon.